We'll hear argument next in case 07544, Hedgepeth versus Polito. Mr. Friedlander.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, respondent has agreed with us that the Ninth Circuit was wrong when it said that the error here and the one in Stromberg were structural defects. The remaining question is whether respondent can salvage the Stromberg rule by making it part of a proper harmless error test, as he attempts to do. His harmless error test is wrong for several reasons, but the Stromberg part of it is wrong for basically one reason. He makes the Stromberg rule into a rule of harmless error, and it is not even a correct rule of error. This Court has defined instructional error to require not merely a mistaken instruction, but a reasonable likelihood that the jury misapplied the law. So when respondent says, invoking Stromberg, that to instruct the jury on valid and invalid theories is harmless error if the jury adopted a valid theory, what respondent is saying is nothing more than that no error occurred in the first place, because the jury found everything it needed to find in order to convict and therefore did not misapply the law.
Do that again, will you?
We need to have a reasonable likelihood that the jury misapplied the law. That's how we get to error. Respondent invokes Stromberg to say, if the jury's instructed a right way and a wrong way, and they went the right way, we have harmless error. No, what we really have is no error at all, because there is the jury did not misapply the law. Moreover, Stromberg is not even a correct rule of error, because under Stromberg, you have error if the jury could have misapplied the law.
Can I interrupt? You're saying no error occurred? On page 11 of your brief, you say unconstitutional instructional error occurred in this case because there was a reasonable likelihood the jury found and so on and so on.
Yes, I agree that error occurred in this case. What I'm trying to argue here is that respondent is entirely off base in importing the Stromberg rule into a harmless error determination. Stromberg is at most a rule of error. Jury went the wrong way. That's a rule of error. But it is not even a correct rule of error, because under Stromberg, you say, could the jury have gone the wrong way? Whereas under this Court's modern precedent, you have to have a reasonable likelihood.
But
that
you
the jury
say that's
went.
What happened here. That's what your brief says.
Yes. I agree that there was a error here, but not because of Stromberg, because there was a reasonable likelihood that the jury misapplied the law.
You should have said no to the question, I think, because I thought the question, whether it was, you're saying that there isn't a reasonable likelihood that its error influenced the outcome.
No.
You're not saying that?
There is a reasonable likelihood that the jury misapplied the law. That's the error question.
Yeah.
Then the harmless error question is, given that they misapplied the law, do we know, under the requisite degree of certainty, Chapman on direct review, Brecht here, that they would still have found him guilty of felony murder under a proper instruction?
Do you agree that the California Supreme Court gave an incorrect explanation to the answer to that question? They said there was no harmless error because the jury made a specific finding that rebutted that, and that finding depended on the difference between the word and or.
I'm not sure I followed the last part of the question, but I agree with you if what you're saying is that the California Supreme Court, in effect, applied a Stromberg-like test. They said necessarily resolved.
No, I'm questioning the basis for the Supreme Court's conclusion that the error was harmless.
Their basis for the conclusion was the jury's special circumstance finding.
Right.
Now, they did not consider when they interpreted that special circumstance the and-or mistake that was embedded in the instructions.
Which meant that the jury really hadn't answered the question they thought it had answered.
No, it didn't mean that. We don't agree with that. We don't believe that that is a correct interpretation of the instruction. But let me skip past that, if you'll allow me. Even if you absent any meaning from that special circumstance finding, okay, and we don't agree with that. But even if you did, you had, at a minimum here,
if you do that, you're removing the basis for the California Supreme Court's decision.
Well,
is that not right? At least it's
the
articulated basis for the California
Supreme Court.
The basis for the decision was the specific reasoning
behind the decision. Yeah, I think that's right.
All right.
Okay. But it doesn't matter, because we're going to apply Brecht anyway.
could you clarify this, the category of cases that would be affected if your argument is accepted? An error would not be harmless under Brecht if it had a substantial or injurious effect, right?
Sure.
Now, what is the standard under California law for submitting a theory of liability to the jury? Presumably, you have to have some evidence in support of it.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I think that goes to the question of whether there is error in the first place in submitting a factually unsupported theory.
Well, you're arguing that there are instances in which, when a theory of liability is submitted to the jury, the error, and it's erroneous, the error can be harmless.
Yes.
Correct? Now, what is the standard under California law for submitting the theory of liability to the jury in the first place? You have to have, presumably it has to be some evidence in support of it, right? How much?
I don't think I know the answer to that question. It would certainly be error under California state law if there is a reasonable they have the same reasonable likelihood standard that the federal courts have. If there is a reasonable likelihood that the jury misapplied the law. Now, but you seem to be focusing on an evidentiary sufficiency, and I think that's governed by Griffin, where if you have insufficient evidence to support the theory, then it's inappropriate.
What I'm asking is, when is there going to be a case in which a theory of liability is submitted to the jury and it's erroneous? Multiple theories are submitted. One is erroneous, and yet it would turn out that the submission of the erroneous theory did not have a substantial or injurious effect.
This case was submitted to the jury on two alternative theories, one of them correct, pre-killing, aiding, and abetting, one of them incorrect, post-killing, aiding, and abetting. And it didn't have a substantial and injurious effect, because we know that at an absolute minimum here, the jury found that the defendant acted, aided and abetted robbery with reckless indifference to human life and as a major participant in the robbery. And those findings were not compatible with post-killing, aiding and abetting.
I thought there were three possibilities, and one was that the defendant didn't do anything before, didn't do anything during, but was simply an accessory after the fact. If the jury believed that, then there was no way they could convict him of the crime that he was convicted of.
Well, the jury rejected accessory after the fact, but
how do we know that? Was there a special verdict?
They were instructed on accessory after the fact as a lesser offense, and they found, in essence, robbery and felony murder.
Yeah, but they found the greater offense, so there would have been no need for them to go to the lesser-included offense. And the trouble is that I think the problem that we're having is that in finding the greater offense, they may have done so under a theory of accomplice liability that was consistent with the accomplice simply coming in at a late stage in the proceeding.
Yes, that's right.
That's the difficulty that we're having.
Yes, there is a reasonable likelihood that in deciding felony murder, they failed to decide that he engaged in the robbery before the killing.
Right.
However, they went and found the special circumstance in which they found reckless indifference, aiding and abetting with reckless indifference to human life, and as a major participant.
I thought the difficulty with using that as a means of answering the first error was that the way the special circumstance instruction was phrased, they could have found the special circumstance without finding anything more than that he came in at a late stage.
No, that's not correct. I don't believe that's correct. It is true that part of the instruction, that and or difficulty, focused on a different question, a different point, said that if you I'm blanking out. It didn't address the reckless indifference to human life in the major participant. But that was embedded in the instructions. And from the start, the courts that have looked at this and have reached this question have all agreed that there was a jury finding of reckless indifference to human life and major participant, and they have disagreed as to what it might have meant. Okay, now the U.S. District Court...
How do we know what the jury found? They just came in with a guilty verdict. Is that right?
No, they came in with a special circumstance finding. And the special circumstance finding that this was...
Isn't the special circumstance finding the one that had the word or in it and therefore allowed the jury to give a post-killing interpretation of the events?
No, the special...
Isn't that what the California Supreme Court relied on?
I agree with Justice Stevens. I thought that was the whole problem. The or and the and is the problem for you.
I'll read from JA-14. This is the special circumstance instruction that was mistaken. The murder was committed while the defendant was engaged in the commission or attempted commission of a robbery, or the murder was committed in order to carry out or advance the commission of the crime of robbery, etc. Now, that finding alone, we agree, if you just follow that finding, that doesn't implicate the defendant. But you have to read at JA-13 the instruction 13, the defendant with reckless indifference to human life and as a major participant aided and abetted in the commission of robbery which resulted in the death of Flores. That's at JA-13. So there were multiple findings here. And the district court, which this is at the bottom of the first paragraph of JA-13.
Yeah, but isn't maybe I'm not getting it. Help me out here. One possibility under the instruction at JA-13 is or assisted in the crime of robbery. And the other instructions, because they are erroneous, leave open the possibility of finding that he assisted in the crime of robbery only if he came in late. And that's why it does not solve the original error.
No. The problem with the – I think you're mixing up two things.
I'm maybe doing that.
The felony murder instructions did not – speak to this question of contemporaneity. They left it open. That was error. We acknowledge that that was error. Okay? So they arguably find felony murder, aiding and abetting felony murder, based on post-killing aiding and abetting. Now the jury has to get to the special circumstance finding.
Yeah.
Right? And now it has to decide, among other things, As I read to you, did he aid and abet robbery with reckless indifference to human life and as a major participant in the commission of a robbery which resulted in the death of Flores?
Mm-hmm.
That's at JA-13. So what
where does it say that he must have assisted prior to the late stage?
It doesn't say that.
Then that doesn't cure the error.
Yes, it does. And the reason that it does is because the harmless error test is not whether the jury actually made the finding that it needed to make. Rather, the harmless error test is, do we know from the evidence and from the findings that the jury would have made the findings that it was required to make had it been properly instructed.
It seems to me that you're arguing one of two things. First, that there was no error at all under Stromberg, or second, that if there was error, it was harmless error. And I thought the case was about whether or not the Ninth Circuit erred in concluding that harmless error analysis didn't apply to a Stromberg error.
Yes. I'm not arguing the first point. I can see there was error. I just wanted to make the point that Stromberg itself is an incorrect rule of error. But I can see that that's led us down a path that I didn't need to go down. Now, we are certainly arguing harmless error. As for the Ninth Circuit's opinion, the Ninth Circuit said, this is structural error. We don't even start a harmless error analysis.
The district court didn't say that.
No, it did not. And we said, that's wrong. This is trial error, not structural error.
Well, if we were to say, Ninth Circuit, you were wrong, but the district court was right.
Well, the district court was right to the extent that it found it to be trial error. It was wrong to the extent that it found it to be prejudicial trial error. But respondent has agreed with us that this is not structural error, that we need to do a harmless error analysis, and what respondent has done is import into this harmless error analysis, we are saying, the Stromberg rule, and it doesn't belong there. The Stromberg rule is not a proper rule of harmless error. It's at most a rule of error.
But do you not agree that the harmless error rationale of the California Supreme Court was incorrect?
Was the rationale incorrect?
Harmless error analysis. I agree with you that there should have been harmless error. Did it perform?
It was incorrect in the way you're thinking it's incorrect, but it was also incorrect in another way. It was incorrect in the way that it applied too strict a standard. It said, has this question been necessarily resolved? And it said, yes, it has been necessarily resolved. Well, that's not the question. That answer was incorrect, and as well as the way you're thinking it was incorrect, in that they premised it on a factual basis that was not, in fact, the case. But I better reserve time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shaw?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I think the Chief Justice framed the main issue in this case properly. Consistent with the last two decades of this Court's instructional error jurisprudence, the Court should hold that the type of error at issue is not structural and is subject to harmless error review. The Ninth Circuit's contrary interpretation of Stromberg creates the untenable result that adding a valid theory to an invalid one somehow makes the error worse. Even respondent now rejects that interpretation. It follows that this Court should reverse the Ninth Circuit and remand for application of harmless error review under Brecht. The main issue
the district judge did, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court did apply harmless error review under Brecht. The Court of Appeals, of course, did not.
It could just review the district court decision using the standard that the district court used.
This Court could do that, but the longstanding and customary practice of this Court is that when the Court of Appeals does not address the harmless error question, that it remands to that Court. It did that in Rose v. Clark, in Pope v. Illinois, in California v. Roy, more recently in Requenco. And in several of those cases, the intermediate court or the district court in a habeas context did address it, and the Court of Appeals didn't. In all of those cases, yet the Court did remand for application of harmless error review.
I wasn't questioning that, but Is the United States position, say structural error was wrong, harmless error was right, and then just have the Ninth Circuit review the district court's decision that held that there was harmless error the way it would ordinarily review a district court decision?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would add that this Court should also clarify the scope of that harmless error inquiry. I think there are two important principles. There's no logical reason to apply a narrower form of harmless error review in this case than the Court did in Nieder. So I think that this Court should clarify that the principles of harmlessness articulated in Nieder should apply on remand in the Ninth Circuit. And I think two of those principles bear mention. First, the question is not what the jury actually or necessarily found, but rather it encompasses what a rational jury would have found absent the error. And I think the second important point for this Court to clarify is that harmlessness review is not limited to cases, where the relevant elements are undisputed, but rather, even when disputed, a reviewing court should consider the entire record and determine whether, in light of the jury findings, there is sufficient evidence to support a contrary verdict. And then it should remand, Your Honor, to the Court of Appeals to apply those principles.
Why do you say in light of the jury finding when you have disavowed any necessity that the jury have found this?
Well, Your Honor,
what
we
mean,
do
in
know
in light of the jury finding, why don't you just drop that?
Well, Your Honor, we think it's important because there are certain jury findings that we know the jury made in this case. The jury returned a special circumstance verdict, and we know based upon that verdict that at a minimum, the jury found that respondent was a major participant in the crime, just taking the facts of this case, that respondent was a major participant in the robbery, that he exhibited a reckless disregard for human life, and we also know that the jury rejected a duress defense. The jury was instructed on that defense, and yet the jury came back guilty. So I don't think that the inquiry should take place in a vacuum, but of course a reviewing court should have the benefit of the limited jury findings that we do know were made, and then apply the sufficiency inquiry in light of those jury findings. There's no reason to disregard the jury findings that were made.
Suppose it's not, in the abstract anyway, necessarily true that this case follows a fortiori, because here at least you had a valid theory. I mean, that may make it a harder case because the jury may have based its entire verdict on an invalid theory. It may be more difficult than a situation where you've got a theory of the case that is invalid because a particular element is missing, and you can look and see whether or not that was harmless or not.
I would disagree, Mr. Chief Justice. I think there are two possibilities in a case with alternative theories. One possibility is that the jury relies upon the defective instruction. For example, there's one element omitted, just like the instruction in Nieder. If that's what the jury had done, then this case is no different than Nieder, no better, no worse, right? The other possibility, however, is that the jury relies on the completely valid theory. If the jury relied on the completely valid theory, then there's even less of a problem than Nieder. There's no problem at all. So I don't see how the error in this alternative valid theory and defective theory circumstance could be any worse.
The difference is when you've only got one theory, you know what they relied on. When you've got alternatives, how do you know which one they relied on?
Well, you don't, Your Honor, and that's what the reviewing court has to decide. But in either scenario, if you assume that the jury relied on the defective theory, then we're in the same box as in Nieder, and the reviewing court would decide whether there was, they would apply the harmless error review to the missing element and decide whether there was sufficient evidence to render that error harmless. Or the court could ask, well, is there uncontroverted or overwhelming evidence that the defendant would have been found guilty under the valid theory? And that would also be a permissible inquiry.
Well, I guess, though, the point is that when you have invalid and valid theories, it may be a little harder than Nieder because they don't have to have made any findings under the valid theory. In other words, you don't just have to fill in a missing piece in the puzzle as a Nieder. You have to — they may have been working off an entirely different puzzle.
Well, Your Honor, in almost all conceivable cases, there's going to be at least some overlap between the two theories. And the reason why that's relevant is because you know that when the jury has returned a general verdict of guilt, they've necessarily found beyond a reasonable doubt that each of those elements has been satisfied.
No, but so in this case, the question is whether the uncle did it or the nephew did it. And if there's a lot of doubt about if there's substantial reason to believe maybe it was the uncle, they might have taken the easy case out. I think this is vastly different from a single theory case.
Well, Your Honor, here's
because
why.
Because there's plenty of evidence that he might have been guilty after the fact. There's just no doubt about that. But there is doubt about the former.
Your Honor, here's why I think the cases aren't that different. Because, you know, at a minimum, from the general verdict of guilt, if you take a case like this, you know that the jury found that there was an unlawful killing, You know that the jury found that there was a robbery. You know that the jury found that respondent was involved in the robbery. The only element
but
that we don't know.
Perhaps after the death occurred. That's all we really know.
It's possible that the jury would have found that, and that's the question that the reviewing court would perform in a harmless error review, just like if there — basically, that is the exact same question the court would form would do under Nieder if the timing element were omitted altogether. The reviewing court would look at the evidence and decide, is there sufficient evidence to support an after-the-fact participation?
So what we're talking about, in other words, is the application of harmless error, which may or may not be harder in the multiple theory case, and not the question of whether harmless error analysis should be applied.
Yes, Your Honor. That's going to be completely fact-dependent whether it's harder or not, but I think analytically it's exactly the same as in Nieder.
Well,
certainly no worse.
Are there going to be cases in which there's enough evidence to support the submission of a theory of liability to the jury, but so little that the court is going to be able to say that it's harmless under — that the submission of the invalid theory was harmless under Brecht?
Yes, I mean, you can imagine a case, take Nieder, right? If the Nieder instruction, the one omitting the materiality element, was submitted to the jury, certainly enough evidence to support it. And then there was another valid theory.
There's this difference that if an element of an offense has to be submitted to the jury, and it may be that it's the element is undisputed, but a theory of liability isn't going to be submitted to the jury unless there's some evidence to support it.
Well, Your Honor, if there is some evidence to support it, if we were in a direct review context, that's the inquiry that Nieder says. So on a clean slate, it might be that if there's sufficient evidence to support a contrary verdict, that that would end the inquiry. But in many of these cases, we're going to know that the jury has made at least some findings, has found some of the elements, and that might inform the harmless error inquiry, just like in this case we know that the jury has found things like a respondent was a major participant, exhibited a reckless disregard for human life, discounted a significant portion of his statement by rejecting the duress defense. There are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. O'Connell.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, unlike the Sarasate case argued earlier this morning, this is a case of conceded constitutional error under the reasonable likelihood standard, the same question which consumes so much of the Sarasate argument. We acknowledge that this is a trial error and that it is subject to the Brecht prejudice standard. And as I believe Justice Souter commented during the Sarasate argument, in a Brecht situation, the defendant wins the benefit of the doubt. That is the lesson of this Court's decision.
I agree with that, and my question is going to be which answer at some point. Both of you seem to agree with that, so pretty much it's a harmless error standard review. I think I wrote a case on that, which says the defendant —
Yes, you wrote on the O'Neill, Your Honor.
Right, and so why don't we just send it back and say apply the standard?
Your Honor, although the Ninth Circuit admittedly used a structural defect nomenclature with which we don't agree, we believe that the Court can — that upon considering both the Ninth Circuit decision and the District Court decision, this Court can affirm because the inquiry which the Ninth Circuit did conduct was actually a case-specific inquiry, not really a structural defect inquiry, and when an examination of the evidence and the verdicts and the instructions and anything else indicative of the jury's thinking still leaves the Court uncertain whether the jurors relied on the valid or the invalid theory, that's a substantial and injurious influence. That is grave doubt. That is equipoise in the language of Your Honor's opinion.
You're saying that I should have grave doubt myself, and any judge would have to. He made an argument here, I think, that wasn't such a bad one. He said, look at it, page 14, and you'll see the mistake, in the joint appendix.
Yes, Your Honor.
There it is. And it's absolutely wrong. The basic instruction under the law says you have to be engaged in the crime, and you have to have a certain state of intent. you have to have committed this murder in order to help the crime, or at least in order to escape.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that's wrong. It's put them together. But then look at the instruction on page 13, which you actually give. On the one on 13 really does seem to say that, or more so. It says you can only apply jury. You can only apply this special instruction if two things are true. First, in lines 9 through 12 of that instruction, it seems to repeat that you have to be engaged in the crime. And then just before that, it says, and you have to have one of two states of mind. You have to either intend to kill the person or at least be recklessly indifferent. And since that's what we said on page 13, the fact we made a mistake on page 14 doesn't matter that much. That's one of his arguments, and I'm sure I have a lot of evidentiary ones and a bunch of other ones.
Your Honor, I think the answer to that question is in the underlying trial reporter's transcript at pages 1015 to 1016, the district attorney's cross-examination of Mr. Pulido. The district attorney developed the theme quite effectively that even under Mr. Pulido's own account, he exhibited reckless indifference because he saw the mortally wounded victim lying there, and the DA said, did you try to resuscitate him? Have you ever had a CPR class? Well, once I did once. Well, did you do CPR on him? No. Did you call 911? You didn't care whether he lived or died, did you? So this entire line of cross-examination, to which the district attorney came back again, though somewhat less dramatically, at 1330 of the transcript and again at 1337 to 1338, commenting that he didn't, that Mr. Pulido did not go back in at some later point to check on the victim's condition. That entire line of cross-examination encouraged the theme that even under Mr. Pulido's own account of the facts, he showed reckless indifference. And
so the error wasn't harmless, and that's an argument you can make before the Ninth Circuit on remand.
That certainly is an argument that if the court is convinced that the Ninth Circuit's analysis in substance, because I realize the nomenclature was inconsistent with harmless error, and I'm not going to defend that. If the court is convinced that the substance of the Ninth Circuit's analysis was so far removed from what harmless error analysis requires in this context, we agree that the usual course would be descended
well,
back.
Well, why don't we just take them at their word? As you say, they're applying the wrong nomenclature. It'd be easy enough for them. We get it back saying, oh, we meant, you know, harmless error under Brecht. But that seems to me to be at least an open question.
Your Honor, I think maybe I could best answer that by offering my own critique of the Ninth Circuit opinion, and which may explain why it may be unnecessary. In my opinion, what the analysis that the Ninth Circuit conducted was equivalent to a sufficient analysis, equivalent to the point of equipoise discussed in O'Neill. That is to say, it reviewed the evidence and said, and the verdicts and the instructions, and said, we're uncertain, we can't tell which way the jury went. My critique of the Ninth Circuit's, at least its per curiam opinion, as opposed to one of the concurring opinions, is that, in fact, this is not just a general verdict case. We know a great deal about the jurors' thinking in this case. We know that by a vote of either 8-4 or 4-8, the jurors rejected the prosecution's primary theory, which was that Pulido personally shot the victim and that, in the prosecutor's words, Aragon had nothing to do with this. Aragon wasn't there. Aragon isn't a murderer. We also know, and this will be another echo of the Sarasate case, we also know that throughout their 5 days of deliberations, the jurors submitted question after question directed to what are concededly defective, erroneous instructions, and moreover, those questions focused right in on the defect in the instructions and, in particular, the timing of Mr. Pulido's assistance. And I refer the Court in particular to the jurors' handwritten diagrams of alternative conceptions of felony murder, aiding and abetting liability, which are at 36 to 38 of the joint appendix, and also the juror's question at page 41 of the joint appendix, whether this goes right, this goes, as this court said, to the crux of the issue. Does the defendant have to have knowledge before or during the crime of the unlawful purpose of the perpetrator? And as to both of those questions, the judge said, go back and reread those same instructions, which, of course, are erroneous. So my critique of the Ninth Circuit opinion, which is, again, slightly different, I think, than the State's, would be that it neglected to mention that compelling evidence that, in fact, the jurors actually found a set of facts corresponding to the invalid late joiner theory. Because in my view, what the analysis the Ninth Circuit conducted gets us to a point of equipoise, and that's enough for Brecht. The defect in the Ninth Circuit's analysis is they neglected to also factor in those juror queries, and in my view, the juror queries move us from a state of equipoise to a very high probability that the jurors relied on and adopted a factual scenario corresponding to an invalid theory.
Under Brecht, you have the burden of showing a substantial injurious effect.
Well, Your Honor, as I understand O'Neill, the court specifically renounced describing it as a burden. In fact, said that we're not going to use burden terminology, and rather than talk about allocating burdens, we're going to address it from the perspective of the judge and say, if the judge is in equipoise, that is sufficient. We also know that, drawing upon the relationship between the Brecht standard and others, we know that a Strickland standard is deemed to — that if you have Strickland prejudice, you don't have to go through a separate Brecht analysis because a Strickland reasonable probability, it also satisfies Brecht's substantial and injurious influence. Well, this Court has said again and again in construing Strickland, it does not require a more likely than not showing. It simply requires a showing sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome.
So you think you win under Brecht?
I think we will under Brecht, Your Honor.
And you think the Ninth Circuit, although it didn't use that label, actually applied the Brecht standard?
In substance, it did, even though I can't run from the language the Ninth Circuit actually used.
Well, then it seems to me that you agree with your friend that the Brecht standard and the government, that the Brecht standard applies.
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
And all the fight is over is whether the Ninth Circuit applied that standard or not.
Yes, Your Honor, whether it applied in a substance.
Why don't we just send it back and ask them? Say, we can't tell. The parties are having disagreement about whether you did. What did you do?
Your Honor, as I said a little earlier, if I fail to persuade the Court that the substance of what the Ninth Circuit did was effectively satisfied Brecht as interpreted in O'Neill, then I agree that's an appropriate course, and we indicated that in the final section of our brief.
There is not sure that would be. I mean, what worries me is proliferating arguments among judges. Why not just say, you know, apply Brecht? I'd like it with the O'Neill gloss, because it seems to me the O'Neill gloss applies.
I agree, Your Honor.
Let's go do it. And then they can say we already did it, or they can say we didn't already do it, but we'll do it now. Let them say what they want to say.
Your Honor, and again, I don't strenuously object to that because, as I've mentioned, if the court remains of the view that what the Ninth Circuit did was simply incompatible with Brecht, then I agree it should be sent back, and I understand why that might be the court's inclination. Let me offer another angle for why what the Ninth Circuit did is entirely compatible with Brecht. In civil cases, this court routinely applies the same sort of general verdict analysis, which in criminal cases has become to be known as the Stromberg line. In fact, it did it as recently this summer in the Exxon Valdez case. Now, civil cases don't have Chapman. They don't have structural defect. Civil cases are subject to a harmless error standard, which ultimately goes back to the identical statute which was construed in Kodiakos. And going back to the opinion of the court in O'Neill, in addressing the relationship between Kodiakos-Brecht harmless error review and civil harmless error review, the court indicated, I think rather strongly, that those standards are either equivalent or, to the extent that they differ, the Brecht-Kodiakos standard is less forgiving of error because of the liberty interest at stake. Now, that means two things. From a retrospective point of view of simply construing this court's different lines of cases, I think it demonstrates that this general verdict analysis is entirely consistent with a Kodiakos-type harmless error analysis. But it also has some prospective implications, because if this court were to wholly disavow that type of analysis and say that has nothing to do with harmless error review, that's going to impact civil cases too. And obviously in all this court's opinions, the court is considering not only the immediate case, but what is going to happen if we rule one way or another. So this case supports a finding of prejudice under that O'Neill equipoise, and that's what the Ninth Circuit did, though that's not what it called it. It even more strongly supports prejudice when one factors in the rest of the record, notably the juror queries, and another item which I think may be responsive to some of Justice Alito's earlier questions, which is the strength of the evidence under various theories. There were three theories, and obviously there was evidence in support of the prosecution's main theory that Pulido shot the victim himself. There was obviously substantial evidence in the form of Pulido's own testimony in support of the invalid late joiner theory. Out of these, the one theory that had least support in the record before the jury was the valid aiding and abetting theory, because no witness testified to a scenario in which Pulido assisted in some fashion or another prior to the shooting, nor did the prosecutor attempt to develop that type of scenario in argument, because the prosecutor was very clear. Prosecutor said, you're going to get aiding and abetting instructions just in case. They only apply come into play if you believe the defendant's story, which was a real whopper, but if you believe the defendant's story, the felony murder rule applies. But then the prosecutor immediately went back, but I don't think it applies at all. Aragon wasn't there. Aragon didn't do it. Pulido did. And the prosecutor went back to his primary theory. So the theory which, though present in the instructions, was least before the jury was the valid aiding and abetting theory. Yet, to find this conceded error harmless depends on the notion either that the jury actually adopted a pre-shooting aiding or abetting, or that they necessarily would have adopted one if properly instructed. There's one final point I'd like to make, which is there's a qualitative aspect to Brecht, and when one has an error under which the defense testimony, even if believed, renders the defendant guilty erroneously, that derails the entire defense. That, it seems to me, is the quintessential substantial and injurious influence, because it practically renders trial a nullity by erroneously telling the jury, even if you find this set of facts, the defendant's guilty. So for these reasons, and additionally for the very thorough prejudice analysis found in the district court opinion, we urge the court to affirm, despite the Ninth Circuit's inapt nomenclature. But in the event the court is dissatisfied with that explanation, we have acknowledged that the appropriate course in that instance would be to send it back under Brecht. Unless the Court has any further questions, I'm prepared to submit.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Friedlander, you have 3 minutes remaining.
We agree that we need to do Brecht. We disagree on what Brecht is. Respondent is telling you that Brecht is the error test, whether the jury relied on the valid or invalid theory. That's what he says Brecht is. In Calderon versus Coleman, this Court said there's a difference between the error test and the harmless error test. All these questions that the jury asked went to the question of error. Did the jury misapply the law by failing to find the contemporaneity aspect of felony murder? They did not go to the harmless error question of what the jury would have done had it been properly instructed. We urge the Court in remanding the case to make clear that the error analysis must be kept separate from the harmless error analysis. This is a mistake Judge Thomas made in his concurring opinion. He sees a mistake in an instruction. He assumes that the mistake rises to the level of constitutional error. And then he does a prejudice analysis by deciding whether the mistake caused the jury to misapply the law. In other words, he applies an error analysis to decide prejudice. And what he does is he includes all this evidence of the questions the jury asked when those questions went only to the misapplication of law that was the error and did nothing to show the basis of the jury's special circumstance finding, which is the heart of the harmless error determination here. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Friedlander. The case is submitted.